Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. This is Blog Talk Radio. I'm Russ Johnson, and we have a wonderful guest this morning. And now we will get to the guest in just a moment. But first, here's a clip with George Green, who studied the industry of aliens and Palladians for at least 40 years before he left us a couple years ago.
Your physical reality that you have, based on this physical life that you have, this dream, is made up of the experiences that is impregnated on your body and in your mind, consciously, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your soul memory is another thing.
Mm-hmm.
It goes back whatever time that you've elected to be in this incarnation for whatever reason. Now, let's show you the division on these things. Since the body is very physical, and we just got you making a physical being in a few months for spare parts, they said, now we've got the perfect deal. How can we have that work better? Well, if you go to the hospital today and get an encephalogram, what's that? That's the memory of your conscious mind. It's on the CD. Let's download it on this being. Now we got a walking, talking duplicate that has the total memory that you have because we just took it off of your own mind.
Okay. It's like Blade Runner, the android.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing is that it's like this DVD recorder. Sometimes you have glitches in it, so you have to have them tuned up occasionally or redone them. And so we take them to Camp David, or there's a wing at Bethesda Hospital, to just tell you. If you go down there and check, you'll find the nurses, if they're willing to come forth, they'll tell you they work on those people, and they call them the others. I thought it was interesting.
Well, that's the voice of George Green. And you can always go to YouTube, and here's a lot of information there. He has a website, too, by the way. It's nohoax.net, nohoax, H-O-A-X.net, and has a lot of information there. We have his wife, Jillian Green, with us, and she was born a clairvoyant and lived in Yorkshire, England, and she was a pupil of Edna May, a well-known Yorkshire clairvoyant, and for many years she has taught metaphysics and done clairvoyant readings for others in the United States and abroad, and she's with us today. Good morning. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Russell. I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. Well, it's wonderful having you, because the last broadcast, I had given it to my son, and he gave it to his friends, and everybody wanted to hear what you have to say further about the ETs and UFOs and being a clairvoyant and the planet and the 12th planet and Sitchins and the whole nine yards, the Anunnaki, if you will. Now, let me do this. The Anunnaki, you are an Anunnaki, and a lot of people just didn't really understand or believe or were not taught that the Anunnaki have been here for 400,000 years, or they were here 400,000 years ago. They left, came back, and they're back with us. Could you give us a brief 1, 2, 3? Let me do this. I'll do this first. Wait a minute. I'm looking for something. I got a person who was describing that whole, and whether you agree or disagree, let me play this about the Anunnaki, the creation of them and why they were here.
The Anunnaki were not gods after all, not even one solitary god. Rather, they were an all-powerful extraterrestrial force that halted from a faraway world called Nibiru. It was a planet which, Sitchin concluded, lurked in the far fringes of our solar system and whose orbit brought it perilously close to the Earth every 3,500 years or thereabouts. In doing so, the massive planet's gravitational pull provoked worldwide havoc and destruction on our planet every few millennia. Hence the reason why so many ancient texts exist that describe worldwide cataclysms thousands of years ago. Genetic manipulation, nuclear war, and gold. In my 2015 book, Bloodline of the Gods, I told the story of how, at least hundreds of thousands of years ago, the Anunnaki dispatched an absolute armada of craft to the Earth with one primary goal in mind. That goal was to plunder our planet of its valuable resources, and specifically its abundant, rich supply of gold. The Anunnaki, however, weren't going to do their own dirty work when they could have someone else do it for them. Using highly advanced technologies, medicine, and science, they chose to genetically alter primitive proto-humans and turn them into a subservient and sterile slave race. They were almost certainly responsible for the Rh-negative blood anomaly that today courses its way through the veins of a small number of the human race, many of whom, as I demonstrated in my book, are intimately linked to the UFO phenomenon, alien abductions, and close encounters. In my follow-up book, 2016's Weapons of the Gods, I revealed how, in the early years of civilization, in portions of Africa and the Middle East, the Anunnaki splintered to the point where faction turned upon faction, and with a catastrophic outcome for both of them and us. The result of this splintering was that Anunnaki violently fought Anunnaki on our planet with tactical nuclear weapons, something which led to the decimation of Sumer and the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, and caused equally massive destruction in northern India, as graphically told and described in the pages of the Indian epic, the Mahabharata. There is, however, a third component to the story of the Anunnaki. It's an important component that takes us down the path toward the domain of immortality. Before we get to the important issue of how exactly the Anunnaki achieved immortality, it is first vital that we are able to make a solid case to the effect that they did indeed manage to conquer death, as amazing as such a thing surely sounds.
Okay, that's from several books that he has written. Any comments about what he has said?
Well, I could talk about it endlessly, of course, knowing me.
Which is good, yes, which is good. We need that information because...
Basically, his story of how they came to the planet with a few minor things I would disagree with is accurate. What is there to say about it? I mean, he's making an accurate statement of the events that occurred with the Anunnaki when they came to this planet. I have really no problem, apart from the fact that they supposedly came with a massive armada, I think are his words, when in fact it was just a few landing craft that originally came down and made a base camp in the Aegean. Their landing place was the Aegean Sea. It was only a few. The most that were ever down at that period of time in that original encampment at Ereba was 400. There were about 400 people altogether, and that built up to about 600 at a later date. So they were never talking about massive numbers. The other thing I might comment on is, you know, the fact that, yes, they did have a nuclear war. It wasn't quite the way he seemed to be describing it, but yes, there was a nuclear war, and it was devastating. It was devastating for the Anunnaki as well as for the Sumerian people on the planet. At the time that that occurred, I was actually living in the city of Ur, and we had to get out very quickly. What happened was the wind changed, and we got all the radiation, you know, the massive radioactive material that's blown in the wind. We got all that coming to the city of Ur, and we had to evacuate very quickly. So yes, it was a devastating experience, and it's quite correct that that all did happen, no doubt.
Wow, isn't that something? But you know, that's not in our history books, if I may. You know,
well, yes, it's true. It's not in the history books most people read, no. But that's probably because they only discovered the Library of Nineveh in this last century, and it's only in the last 60 years that Zachariah Sitchin predominantly, although there were one or two others well known, who have translated some of those tablets and given us this history. So it's not surprising that it's not in our history books, because it was all buried. You know, the information was literally physically buried under the sands of the Middle East.
Okay. But since the researcher, who's a prolific researcher and great writer, I think he's gone now, Zachariah Sitchin, right?
Yes.
He wrote about the 12th planet. What do you mean by the 12th planet? I didn't understand that. And I haven't read that book yet.
Well, what he was saying, his contention was that we have 10 planets in our solar system, if you count the sun and the moon as planets, right? We have 10 planets according to, you know, astrologers or astronomers, and they count 10, right, with the sun and the moon. And then there is an 11th, which is not included normally. And then there is this other planet which comes in, passes through our solar system and goes again every 3,000, say actually every 1,500 years, because it's a 3,600-year orbit that it's on. So it's in our system about 1,000 years of that traveling time. And Sitchin was making the contention that because of the connection of the Anunnaki to Earth, we should count Nibiru as a planet within the solar system. So that's why he calls it our 12th planet. Right?
I see.
It's not
12. Right.
It's counting it as the 12th planet in the solar system. That's just a way of finding a title for the book. It's not of importance itself.
Okay. But that's some quite his book dealing with the Anunnaki. I guess you've read it time and time again and other materials by him. But that material is not in the average college or university. Would you believe that? But you say because...
The Sumerian history is well researched in our universities, in many universities. I mentioned to you one other time, the University of Pennsylvania has a big department of Sumerian, to do with the Sumerian history. Yes, it's in the universities, the ancient history. It's just not in common reading. And what put it in common reading was Sitchin's books that he actually brought out in paperback. You can get hardback copies, but he brought them out very early on, if not originally, in a paperback edition, so that they would go worldwide, and they have. So there's nobody anywhere who hasn't had the opportunity since the 1970s to read about this, because Sitchin's books went into, I think, 13 languages, and they went worldwide. They're everywhere. Everywhere you go, you can find Sitchin's books on the 12th planet and the wars of gods and men and the whole range of his books that were essentially all about the Anunnaki's presence on this planet and the effect that they had on history, particularly South America.
Okay, and we will talk about that in a minute. But all the books that you have mentioned a few minutes ago can also be found on your late husband's website, which is nohoax.net. nohoax.net. And he knew all that history. And as he traveled around the world at least for 40 years, what prompted him to do all that kind of travel and spend all that kind of money trying to get us to understand that there were aliens among us, number one, and that we have a history that goes back 500,000 years. What prompted him to do it? Do you get involved
in
that
process?
I
think George's curiosity was stirred up when he was a young man, when he was only an 18-year-old, 19-year-old in the U.S. Air Force, and down at Andrews Air Base. And somewhere down there, they had a hangar which had a captured or a claimed spaceship, one of the small ones. And they told George it was I think they told him it was a Sikorsky helicopter or something. They told him a story about it, and he said he knew that wasn't true, and he started inquiring. And then he had experiences with seeing UFOs over the years, over the next several years. And eventually he decided that he would start a publishing company, primarily to publish the works of whistleblowers. He knew some people who had come out of the CIA originally, and they were telling some stories about what was going on in government. And nobody would publish the books they were writing. So George got busy and started a publishing company, America West, and began publishing these books. And then he got into the UFOs and came across the Billy Myers material, went to Switzerland, met Billy Myers, had an interaction with Semyasi and Quetzal. They asked him to publish a book for them, which was the Handbook of the New Paradigm. And so these people who were claiming to be extraterrestrial Pleiadians dictated the books to him. He published first the handbook and then the two subsequent books, and then a little booklet called Messages to the Ground Crew. So there was the handbook, Something Over the Rainbow or To the Rainbow, and a book called Becoming. Becoming is a nice little spiritual book. I quite like that one. And that's how he really got so involved with it all, through having his publishing company and putting those books out. He would go out every weekend or every other weekend to groups all over the country, talking to them about what was happening on the planet. And he got all his information from these people that he knew in government, through his own history and connection with government, and through connections that he maintained in government. So he was getting his information straight, as it were, from the horse's mouth. And he would go out and tell people, this is what's happening in our country, this is what's happening on the planet, and this is what you need to be prepared for. So George's original interest was not really the ETs and the UFOs. His original interest was economics, the global economics, and helping people or advising people on how to prepare for the really hard times that were coming, you know, preparation for the 2008 crash and things. So that was, he'd been doing that work a long time before he published the handbooks for the extraterrestrials. And when he published those, they seemed to kind of take over and become bigger focus of what he was talking about, this necessity for spiritual renewal on the planet. So that was basically George's interest.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I interviewed him, my first time I met him in 1992, and he brought with him on that interview, and I have to play that one of these days, with Colonel Wendell Stevens, who wrote 18 books on the subject.
Yes.
Let's talk about Colonel Wendell Stevens a bit. He's gone now. He crossed over. But let's talk about his expertise, his talent, and why Joyce was so close to him and helped him publish the 18 books, which may be still found if you look at nohoax.net. It's probably still being able to find it on that website. Talk about Wendell for a minute.
You know, I only met Wendell Stevens once briefly at a UFO conference, not long before he died. But George knew him very well, and he knew his daughter. And even after Wendell passed, George had all the manuscripts, I believe, for Wendell's books, and his daughter gave George permission to go ahead with them. But the project never got done, simply because George himself died, you know, within a year or so of Wendell. So it sadly never got done. And his books are very difficult to find now. They were not a mass publishing. I think Wendell had them published himself, and there was not a massive print of them. So they're kind of hard to find these days, I believe. But he was a most interesting man, with a huge, huge range of experiences himself that he would talk, when I'm talking about Wendell, that he would, you know, talk about at the UFO conferences and discuss. He was highly respected because he was a brilliant man. You know, there was no, he was not some quirky person who wears tin hats. He wasn't like that at all. He was very grounded, very down to earth, and very knowledgeable. And his experiences were quite remarkable. They covered such a wide area of interactions with other people, with other people's stories, and with his own experiences. So I would say if anybody is interested in, they can get a hold of Wendell's books. They're well worth reading.
Of course. And he was also in the Air Force, and he was a colonel, and he was a pilot for many,
yeah.
many, yeah. Right?
Yes. Brilliant man. Brilliant.
Brilliant man, yeah. But however, George also talked about soul energy, and I wanted to address that. Here's just a small clip, but let's address that issue of soul energy.
It exists right now and what we're creating. And it's not only the we, it's everybody else that's involved in their thought processes that is being coalesced from the creation in order to try to figure a way to come back out of this with the least destruction to the soul energy.
Absolutely.
And that's what we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And the soul has to wake up and say, wait a minute, there's something above me. See, the ego keeps you back down to the me, I, and all that kind of stuff. We're all together. I love you all. We don't care. We're all one.
All right, let's talk about that soul energy he's talking about. Could you expand on that?
I don't know what George was talking about.
Oh.
I honestly do not know what George was talking about. I know what I would be talking about with soul energy, but I
Please.
Mean I can't say whether we were actually talking about the same thing at that time. To me, the energy that activates the individual soul is what we would otherwise call the divine spark, that charge of energy that comes directly and only from the source of everything, and that is the activation of life, and that when you receive that activation as an individualized unit or expression of the source, as a person, as a whatever you are, right, then you have the use of that energy from the time it's given to you for as long as you keep adding to it. In other words, it's kind of like, you know, if you put a charged battery in a car, the car will keep running and the battery will keep self-charging so long as you run the vehicle, put miles on it, or you just do stops and starts all the time. The battery will drain away. You're not feeding anything, and you wake up one morning with a dead battery. But if you look after that battery and take it on a long run every day, it's going to recharge itself. And essentially, this is what happens with the soul. You are given as a gift the divine spark that makes you alive, a living being, and that energy belongs to you. It's up to you by the choices you make through your life to add energy to it. Every time you make a good choice, a choice which is in harmony with the universe and the creation, then you add energy, and that is soul energy. Right, that is, you build your soul. You build the energy of your soul around that divine spark, like a pearl in an oyster. And every time you get it right, you add energy, you polish the pearl. Every time you get it really, really wrong, then you draw energy to keep you alive. And so you're using up your soul energy and you have less. So the goal is to try and make right choices and add energy to your soul.
Okay.
And this is an ongoing process from lifetime to lifetime.
Okay. You know, I've talked to people who have said that on planet Earth, the distinct feature of being human, number one, is have a soul. But, and then that same person told me that of all the species in the universe that they knew, and then there are hundreds of thousands, millions, I guess billions of entities, I mean, you can't get to know them all, and you can confirm that or not, that none of them have soul but the human being here on Earth. Is that true, or is it, am I wrong?
Well, I don't know every being who ever existed or doesn't exist in the universe. I don't know that, but I do know that we're not the only ones with soul potential, because we're not the only sentient beings who have ever existed in the universe. And therefore, we are not the only ones who've had the potential for going forward with souls. There is, however, a distinct difference, and this is true about Earth humans. We do have a different thing because of the Anunnaki, right? Now, let me put it this way. This is not a short story. Don't ask me for a short answer.
No. We don't need short stories.
Okay.
Okay.
Right. What I just said about the soul, keep that in mind. The soul is the divine spark with energy that you build around it, like a pearl in an oyster. That is how your soul is, right? Now, that divine spark came from the source, belongs to the source, and can always go back to the source, right? The pearl, the soul, the energy around it that you have created through a lifetime belongs to you. You carry that forward, and if you have enough energy at the moment that you die to carry your soul forward into another life, you have that same soul energy to start the next life. And you keep adding and adding and adding from lifetime to lifetime to lifetime. It is always your soul and your soul energy. However, that lifetime to lifetime reincarnational process lasts as long as your creation lasts. Science and see what happens in the universe. Planets evolve in the universe, whether they're made of stardust or whatever. You get a planet, and that planet is in a system with a sun that keeps it, gives it life, right? That sun eventually dies, as our sun will in a few billion years. That sun dies, it goes red dwarf, I think they call it. The heat goes, and everything on that planet dies. It just becomes a frozen lump of rock again. Now, hear what I just said. Everything dies, including all those people. And only the energy from the original energy from the source will return to the source. The people, if as they are not immortal, they might think they're immortal, because they have reincarnated time after time after time, so long as their planet was up and running. But when their planet died, they died with it, because they were material beings and hadn't developed their spirituality. In order to continue as an immortal being, you have to not only use the material life to have the sensory experiences from which you can learn, but you have to have the spiritual life, which you are applying your learning to do, to develop and to develop your soul energy. Now, the great thing about Earth and the connection with the Anunnaki, and I know there have been other planets connected with the Anunnaki through the millennia, so I'm sure there have been other planets out there that have the same story I'm just going to tell you right now. The Anunnaki did the genetic engineering, and they took out four genes out of the human, and they put in two of their own genes. Now, this is super important, because the Anunnaki are immortal beings. That is to say, they are beings of light, created out of light by the Creator from the beginning. They have always been creatures of light. They are not birthed out of a physical reality. They didn't rise up from some ocean and, you know, crawl ashore and develop arms and legs and become human, or they didn't do any of those things related to the physical. They were put into the universe, fully formed by the Creator as beings of light. So they were immortal beings from the beginning. They have never been anything else but immortal beings, beings of light. And when they did the genetic engineering, although they were wrong to do it, and they shouldn't have interfered, and they're in big trouble for it, nonetheless, they gave humanity on this planet a great gift when they give them two of their own genes, because now they have given humanity on planet Earth the ability to become immortals, true immortals, so that when our sun of 5 billion years from now dies and this planet and all our little quadrant of creation goes into oblivion, human souls do not need to disappear, do not need to lose their self-awareness. They can continue on indefinitely if they choose to, if they claim their immortality and choose to develop their spiritual selves, choose to advance their souls, choose to expand their spiritual learning, then they too can become immortals and supersede all physical life and death. That's the gift of the Anunnaki to humanity. And that's what we almost never hear about. We only hear the criticism of the Anunnaki. And I agree, they did all those bad things. They deteriorated themselves from the beings they originally were. They've fallen way, way low, in their density and everything else. But it doesn't change the fact that they are beings of the beginning, are true immortals, and have given that gift for potential immortality to every human on the planet. That's why one of the main reasons why everybody wants to come to this planet. That all the billions of souls that are crowding onto this planet, because this is the place where you can become immortal. This is the place where you can conquer death. And you cannot do that anywhere else in the universe. And Christ came and do it the way I tell you. If you follow my way, you can have eternal life, means you become an immortal, as opposed to if you don't do what I tell you, you will die. When the planet dies, you're gone.
So the human being can attain immortality.
Absolutely.
How many incarnations would that take? Or is dependent upon...
You know what? It isn't a matter of quantity. It's quality.
Uh-huh.
It's not quantity. Right. I remember David giving me years and years ago, 20-odd years ago, I put together a little book of the teachings of David, different things he'd told me, and it was called The Chalice of the Dove. And in there, there's one page, and the facing page has like a pin man drawing that I did, which is a terrible drawing, but it's a picture of a person standing and lines coming out from them, and the lines, one line goes to the physical, and then the mental, and then the emotional, then the spiritual. And the little page of instruction that goes with it tells you that if you can live in such a way that your choices are going to be putting other people before yourself, never putting yourself first, always putting other people before yourself, and then detach step by step from the reality that you live in. First, you detach from material things. Well, that's fairly easy to do. We can all let go of material things if we want to. And then we detach from the emotional things, the things that we, just feel very emotional about. But we actually have an emotional attachment to almost everything. And then we detach from the things that we are mentally attached to, which is probably the hardest, because what we know is what we value most in ourselves. So letting go of our status, of our knowledge, of our position in life, if you're a doctor, getting to the point where you want people to call you Joe, not doctor, right? When you get to that stage, that's pretty hard to do because it's taken you many years to become a doctor. Letting go of the things we know, of our knowledge, in my experience, is the hardest thing to do. But when you have detached physically, emotionally, and mentally from the things in this life, then your only connection with your soul is your spiritual body. And so you are living true spirit. You are, your soul is directing your life, not, you know, your paycheck or your banker or money or position, but spirit. And when you get to that stage, I remember David telling me that if somebody was really serious, they could easily go through that process in 2 years. And he said, and if they are determined and absolutely 100% ready to put themselves through that process, they could put themselves through in 2 weeks if they wanted to.
Wow.
And so how long it takes to reach that level where your spiritual self is running your life is entirely up to you. We can all do it, and it's not hard to do, or at least certainly not hard to understand how to do it, right? But it's sometimes difficult to let go of things. And until we can let go of everything and really not have concerns, and of course, the great biggie, and I know you and I have spoken of this before, the biggest thing and hardest thing for most of us to let go of is fear. Fear in all its forms. Fear we won't have a roof over our head. Fear we won't have enough money to pay our bills. Fear is the thing that controls us, and it's the thing most used by the bad people on the planet to control and manipulate us, is our fear. So learning to let go of fear is the very hardest thing that any of us can do, I think. But it's necessary, because without letting go and detaching bind you to this planet, including fear, right, you're never going to be able to love unconditionally. And until you have humility and can love unconditionally, you're not going to be able to truly advance your soul to where it needs to be to become an immortal being. So it's a hard road to walk, but it's a simple road to walk. It really is a straight and narrow way. You know, they talk about the straight and narrow way. Well, that's what it is. It's like following the railroad track of humility and unconditional love. But those two things are not possible. Still have attachments to the things that exist in the material world. And until you do the detaching, you can't truly have faith and trust of spirit, trust in higher authority, trust that there is a creator somewhere out there who really cares about you, trust that your needs will be taken care of. We're told, you know, about the lilies in the field. We should be like the lilies in the field who don't have cares at all. Well, it's very hard to be a lily in the field on this planet for anybody, because we have so much going on. So the path of detachment is important, very important.
Okay, but did you write about that in your books? Let's talk about the book, and I think
the little book has, yeah. The little book has the instruction on how to walk that path, yes.
And that's on that website, nohoax.net, right?
Yes.
It's available.
Yes. They have it there.
Let's talk about what's in your book. I mean, why did you write those books? And what was the essence of writing the book in a paragraph or two?
The essence was to offer practical, short and truthful instructions, which I had received directly from spirit, right? This is not from anybody else or from my own thinking or from books I read. It was all direct information from spirit that was given to me to teach me, and that I used all those pieces of information. Basically, the book was put together in a question and answer form. So a question was asked and then answered by what spirit had said about it. And that's what